Hi everyone, my name is Grant Apt and I'm joined by Mark Fogarty, and we're members of staff in Sport Health and Exercise Science in the School of Life Sciences at the University of Hull. And today we're going to talk very briefly about open access. So I'll start by explaining briefly what open access is. Traditionally, with academic research journals, the researchers would do the research, write up the research as a manuscript, and then submit that manuscript to an academic journal for publication. That journal would then sell a subscription of that journal to libraries and individuals around the world for various prices. And so the cost of the production of the manuscript in its published form is borne by the end user. In more recent times, with open access, the model has changed so that the researchers bear the cost of the production and publication of the manuscript, so that it's free to the end user. So essentially that's what open access is. So certainly for the end user, the general public and everyone else other than the researcher, it's a very good thing because they get the benefit of the research for free. And for those inside of universities, like students, for example, they can also access all open access publications for free. And that's good because although universities have a subscription to a very wide array of journals, we don't have subscriptions to all of them. So there may be journals that we don't subscribe to, but if they're open access, then students can get access to the full paper, which is what we want the students to be accessing. Abstracts, which is the summary of a journal article, abstracts have always been free to view, but as educators, we want students to access the full article rather than the abstract. Maybe Mark, would you discuss why that's the case? Why do we want students to get access to the full paper rather than just the abstract?
Thanks, Grant, and thanks for that overview on open access journals. Excuse me. I suppose what we really want is the students to engage with the full information contained within the research article. The abstract will only give you a basic summary and an overview of the main results and the main findings. And in some ways, from an educational point of view, though that summary piece of work is less open to interpretation by the student. So we want the students to read more, and we want the students to read more from a variety of authors. And in doing so, they develop their own writing style. By reading the introduction in depth, they'll get a better background understanding of why the experiment was done. And then by reading the discussion in a little more depth, they'll get a more detailed overview of the results, the findings, but also, I suppose, more importantly, the limitations within the research. So what did the author set out to do, and what did they actually end up doing? And they then start to draw their own conclusions in terms of, well, the author have said this in the introduction, they employed methods that doesn't actually investigate the experimental question at hand, so therefore in what context can you summarise the conclusions in effect. So for me personally, open access is a great way for students to get a much wider breadth of information available to them, which is a great thing.
Okay, thanks Mark. Yeah, so for both researchers and students it's good, but what about the general public? What do you think, obviously the general public get the article for free because that's what open access is about.
I suppose for me as a scientist, one of the key things that we always say when we conduct research is disseminating research findings. What does that mean? And I suppose that means trying to find out something new and explaining it to as many people as possible. One half of me, and I suppose you could say a slightly arrogant side of me, would put that hat on and say, well, what's the dangers of the general public having information freely at hand that they don't potentially necessarily fully understand. And there's that old adage is, I can't remember what it is actually. Do you know what I'm talking about?
A little knowledge is dangerous.
Yeah, a little bit of knowledge is dangerous. And there's a lot of, especially in our field, there's a lot of information out there about physical activity, cardiovascular disease, nutrition, diet, and it's not easy to interpret it. And it's not easy to interpret as somebody who has 10 years of experience working in the field, let alone the general public who doesn't really have the same theoretical background that I did when I did my undergraduate degree and then when I did my PhD. So part of my job, I guess, moving forward, if I'm writing for open access, does that then mean I have to change the way in which I write so that more people can understand things at a more fundamental lesson? What do you think about that, Brian?
Yeah, I think there's arguments on both sides. Certainly, academic research, the primary audience for academic research has always been other researchers. So I wouldn't say we need to change the way we write in the academic journal, because the primary audience are people who understand what we're trying to say. But what I do think we need to do is turn that information into a more easily digestible form for the majority of the public who will not have the basic understanding, in order to be able to understand the way in which the research has been done, let alone the theoretical content of a journal article. So I wouldn't change the way I write a scientific article, but I think we need to disseminate the content of that article in different formats, and using things like Twitter and Facebook and blogs and short form videos and podcasts like we're doing now, I think are good ways of doing that, so that the researchers still get the nitty-gritty scientific version of what was discovered, and for the very interested in the general public, if it's open access, they can read it, and if they can understand it, that's brilliant. But we certainly do have to certainly make it more accessible. There's lots of things that lots of jargon in research that only researchers will know the meaning of, and it's not to say that people in the general public don't have the capacity to understand. That's clearly not the case, but every field of study has its own form of language, and that can be very difficult for people from the general public to grasp. And but at least it's freely available to anybody, and if they want to have a crack at it, then by all means, go for it.
I don't mean to discourage or say anything bad about people in the general public. I don't mean for one second that they don't necessarily understand the material. I'm sure they're more than capable of going away and learning that material. I guess it's the in-between parts. It's the for example, you would write a research paper in your area. There's other authors in your area, and there is a story in between the papers that, unless you're really familiar with the literature, you would miss out on. And I guess that's the danger with a single research article that's open access, is the general public don't have, because other journals aren't open access, they don't have access. How many times do you say access here? But they don't have that information at hand, so they miss the interpretation, I guess, between the gaps. But let me just play devil's advocate for one second. This role that we as researchers have to undertake now with open access and with Twitter and with multimedia, in some ways, do you feel that our job has completely changed? 10 years ago, we would have been focused on simply doing the research. And the role of the open access that's now taken up is probably what used to be mainstream media. So we would write a research paper, mainstream media pick up on the headlines, they come to us and do an interview and then interpret that into the lay people, and they then generate that, who are specialists at communicating to the wider audience. So in some ways, I guess, do you think we are walking on toes of a different discipline? And B, is it then more challenging as a scientist that we've got to spend too much time being media savvy in a way and not enough time on our actual research?
There's some pretty meaty questions there, Mark. I see it as a really good opportunity for us, mostly because we've got direct access to people. So you don't have to go through a third party like traditional media. And we've all heard, we've all read the horror stories of how, you know, a journalist can misinterpret our research and for the sake of a good headline, and that can create the wrong impression of what the research is about, or could even be dangerous. Nowadays, every researcher has a voice. Their message is under their control. So all they need is a Twitter account now, pretty much, or their own blog, and they can get their own message in their own words out to people who they think would be interested in their research. So it's not to say that that's the only way to do it, and certainly mainstream TV particularly is very powerful, and we've seen the effect that mainstream TV can have. You know, people like Brian Cox, or you know, even David Attenborough over the years, you know, giving scientific information to people can be very powerful, and it's probably still more powerful than an individual on Twitter tweeting away. But at least that is the scientist, Brian Cox, in his own voice, giving the information rather than someone else. So I would say nowadays it's, yes, in many ways it's a lot easier to control the message, but it's a lot more work because you're then having to do that yourself rather than hand it off to a marketing person or to a journalist, and they then construct the story around that. Now, which is better? I would argue that it's better being under our control, but many academics would see the time commitment as a barrier, and that's why still very few academics are engaged in social media, either with their own blog or there's quite a number on Twitter now, of course, but I would, that's of course, you know, a micro piece of information, whereas a blog or a longer form is a lot bigger commitment, but then of course you've got the room to explain things in a little more detail. But we've got a long way to go, I think, in academia in terms of the dissemination of our research findings to the general public, mostly because that kind of information is still largely unrewarded for academics because it's not part of the key metrics that we're judged on. Now, that might change in the future, and I would hope that it does, because I think we do have a responsibility. You know, the general public pays our wage. The general public mostly pays for the research that we do. So I believe it's our responsibility to give the information back to the general public in a form that they can readily digest. So at the moment, it's largely up to individuals off their own back to do that in their own time. But I'm hopeful that in the future it might be part of, as we call it, the workload model that is, you know, included in how we're judged in terms of the amount of work that we do. But, you know, time will tell. If the more open access becomes you know, part of mainstream academia, once it's the mainstream, most journals are still not fully open access in the sense that, you know, that they do still sell subscriptions, but, you know, in 50 years' time, it might be everything's free to everybody, and so time will tell. And I think that's about all we've got, unless you've you've got more to talk
about. I've got more to talk
about. Okay, okay.
You raised an interesting comment about metrics, mm-hmm. and is this something that we haven't really touched on in the discussion yet, but I think it's quite important to address, and that is research quality. The traditional journal would have an impact factor, and most authors aim to publish in the highest impact factor they could possibly find within their own research area. And as flawed or as perfect or as unflawed as that may be, it's still a metric of quality. With open access, the same process doesn't exist. And I guess for me, being slightly sceptical, and again, playing devil's advocate a little bit, if the author is paying for the publication in advance, you could argue that in some cases, the quality of the research is diluted down a little bit because the publisher wants the author's publication fee, of course. And then perhaps the scientist is a little bit less fussy in terms of their research design, how well the paper's written, if they, and I'm being very sceptical here, if they can quite simply think the process through, well, I'm going to pay to get it published, it's going to be a little bit easier, therefore, to get it published, so the quality of the research doesn't necessarily need to be as good as well. So what would be your thoughts on that process?
Yeah, you raise some interesting points. I don't know. I may not agree with them. I think, yeah, it depends on the quality of the journal. I think if you're... There's two types of journal. There's your traditional journal that have always been in print and have developed a reputation and profile over many, many years of publishing academic work. Those journals and now offering open access. Okay, so as a researcher, you can submit to journal X, and if it gets accepted, the journal will then offer you, if you pay us the money, we'll make it open access. Contrast that with the new journals that have sprung up since, well, the start of the internet, that are internet-only journals, and their whole model is based around open access, is based around the researcher paying for the manuscript to be published. They're the ones that you're probably thinking of, and they're the ones that have most recently got... I suppose some of them have been termed rogue journals, where they're offering to publish everything and anything that gets submitted to them with the very lightest touch of peer review. But some of the big players in open access, like Public Library of Science, Plus One, Frontiers, those kinds of offerings... as someone who's done reviews for those journals, I can vouch for the rigor of the peer review process. So, yeah, what it does point to, I suppose, is that as a researcher, you do have to do your homework on the journal. In the past, we could sort of rely on a core group of traditional journals that we could submit to. Now, there's literally hundreds you could submit to, and so separating the wheat from the chaff is something that we have to deal with.
And just a note for our students, how would they, what advice could you give in terms of identifying which journals are more traditional and better? Therefore, we want our students to read the best quality research they can get their hands on, or do we want our students to read everything and let them decide for themselves what's good and what's bad in terms of the methodology and the approach that the actual output is taken. So regardless of where it's published, you can still get a really, really good journal in a what would be considered, or a really good research article published in what would be considered not such a great journal. You can also get fantastic, a publication in a fantastic periodical or journal like Nature, but the quality of the research maybe isn't up to scratch and it's managed to slip through the net. So what kind of advice would you have for students out there?
We're dealing with some really big questions today.
Were we not supposed to?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. As you alluded to before, the impact factor, which has been around for a long time, is a surrogate measure of quality. And as we know, it's an extremely flawed measure of quality, because the impact factor itself is a highly skewed number, and very few of the papers that are published in a high impact journal actually contribute to that high number. There's a very long tail. So there's a lot of papers in very high impact factor journals that aren't cited very often. And so, yeah, that's just one measure of quality, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And that contrasts actually with the REF, the Research Excellence Framework, which is what the government uses to assess researchers in universities. And the REF guideline is that it doesn't matter where it's published. So in that sense, I totally agree with you. I think it shouldn't matter where it's published, and it should be up to the individual reader of that paper to assess the quality of the science based on what's written. And so whether it's in Nature or whether it's in a journal that's been around for 2 days, it shouldn't matter. Unfortunately, we're human beings and we have all of the biases that come along with being a human being. And as you know, Mark, academia is a very traditional sphere, and so things take a long time to change, and the impact factor has been around for a long time, and it's ingrained itself in academic psyche. And so we find it very difficult to separate the quality of the paper from the impact factor. And I totally agree that for the benefit of students, what we're wanting them to do is do exactly that, irrespective of where it's published. And that's irrespective of the type of thing that you're reading. So you could be reading a very, very high quality piece of research in a low impact factor journal, and the exact opposite, which is what you alluded to before. But also, that applies to anything that you read. So you could be reading an article in a newspaper, and what we want students to be able to do is apply that same level of critical analysis to that article in the paper that they apply to the journal article. So it shouldn't really matter where something is published. We want students to have that critical eye and that level of critical analysis to say, you know, this article about the US presidential race at the moment and talking about something about Donald Trump, well, you know, what's the evidence that the journalist has got their facts right? It's exactly the same process as reading a journal article. So, So yeah, you're right. It shouldn't matter where it's published. But I guess, we want things to be fair, don't we? So when it comes to getting our research published, I go through the traditional route, and it takes me many, many months to get my paper published. But you pay an internet journal and get it published in 2 days, then, you know, I'm going to be a bit cheesed off because, yeah, you know, I went through the inverted commas correct route and you've taken a shortcut. So I suppose from that point of view, you know, going through, I would say acknowledged journals rather than traditional journals. Yeah. And, you know, your question before about how do you tell, well, the easiest way to tell is to go to the journal website and see if it's got an editorial board. It should have an editor in chief, and it should have an editorial board that has recognised researchers as section editors. So the website that lists the editorial board, it should say the person's name, it should give their email address, it should give their institutional affiliation address. So you can actually go and see if that's a real person. They're a real academic researcher at a recognised university. You can also tell if the journal is affiliated with a professional body. So, for example, Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise, which is one of the top journals in sport and exercise science, is published on behalf of the American College of Sports Medicine, which is an established professional body. In the UK, the Journal of Sports Sciences is published on behalf of BASES, which is the sport and exercise science professional body. So that's another indicator of quality, or at least recognition that people in that field have recognised that this outlet for academic papers is recognised by the people within that organisation. I hope you've got something out of that very brief discussion on open access, and please make the most of Open Access Week. Okay, bye.